And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and our theme today is all business, all the time. All three of my guests are discussing business or financial matters. My first guest is a financial guru. He recapped January 2011 in the financial markets for us, and he explained the January effect. My second guest is the leader of APLS Group, a training, consulting, and recruiting organization. We discuss the 18 common mistakes that small business owners make. My next guest is a business school professor at the Haas Business School at UC Berkeley. He'll tell us how to keep the United States companies competitive in the global economy by delivering improved choices for customers and better economics for corporations from his latest book titled Open Services Innovation. As always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Henry Chesbrough is best known as the father of open innovation, at least according to Wikipedia.com. He's authored the book Open Innovation back in 2003, before the term came into general use. Today, there are more than 13 million entries for open innovation, if you check online, documenting the rapid rise of this new model of industrial innovation. Open Services Innovation, Rethinking Your Business to Grow and Compete in the New Era, is Henry's latest book, which extends the idea of open innovation into the service sector. Whether you make a product or a service, open innovations can accelerate your time to market, share risks, and boost your growth for business. Professor Chesbrough teaches, as I said, at the Haas Business School at UC Berkeley, and he runs the Center for Open Innovation there as well. Welcome to the show, Henry. How are you today?
Oh, Bill, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Well, thank you for being my guest. And this is so important that we really need to get it out on the table for my listeners, many of whom are small business owners themselves. And let me just start by stating the statistic that services today comprise roughly 80% of economic activity in the United States. To me, that was a staggering number. And worldwide, it's 60% of economic activity in the top 40 economies in the world, according to the OECD. So why did you choose now to turn your attention to the services economy?
Well, as your introduction so nicely pointed out, I started writing about open innovation about 8 years ago. And at that time, I was writing about new products and new technologies. But as I began to look around and talk to people in companies, and one of them I had a talk with was IBM, more than half of their revenues in this company that was famous for new products and new technologies was now coming from a part of IBM called IBM Global Services. And this is an organization that basically supports and maintains your customers' information technology, both hardware and software. No matter whose stuff it is, no matter who sold it to you, they take care of all of it. And this is now more than half of the company's revenues. And so as you point out, the economic statistics at the level of the economy, I was seeing the same thing in companies. More and more of companies like IBM or Xerox or General Electric, as well as I suspect many smaller businesses, the revenues are coming more and more from the services that wrap around the products and technologies rather than just the products and technologies themselves.
All right. Now, you're on record, Henry, as saying that we've been product-centric for too long, and that's a big admonishment. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, one of the best-known and best-regarded business school professors is a guy named Michael Porter.
Yes.
Who has this wonderful series of books on how companies can obtain and maintain a competitive advantage in the market. And one of his main concepts is what he calls the value chain, which is the series of activities from the raw material through to the final consumer that, you know, really add value for the customer. And if you look at his graphic for that, it's a bunch of operational activities, a bunch of support activities, and at the very, very end of the process is what he calls service, which is just this little thing to kind of sell the product and keep the customer happy. But the kind of services that IBM is talking about and the kind of services that are growing the economy today aren't just the things that come at the very end of the process, but these are things that are actually built into the process right from the very beginning and continue well after the sale of the product, so that instead of a customer being a transaction, a customer becomes a relationship that has a series of recurring interactions and recurring revenues back and forth between you and your customer.
All right. We hear a lot about that. Transactions are less important than relationships. So for my listeners who are kind of sitting there scratching their head going, what is he talking about? Give us some examples. And I love the example that you give with Amazon, because everybody knows Amazon. So help conceptualize it for my audience by talking about Amazon, please.
Yeah. Well, in fact, let me just lead into it with an even simpler example, and then I'll get to Amazon, because Amazon gets a little more complicated. The simple example is, think about Motorola making cell phones back 8 or 9 years ago. They had a big breakthrough product called the Razr, which had this really cool, slim design. And Motorola sold more than 50 million of these units and was the world's number one cell phone manufacturer. But when Motorola tried to come out with a new product to follow up on it, it didn't do quite so well. And Nokia kind of took over from them with a really cool clamshell product that had its own excellent design, and they sold even more units and became globally cost competitive. But as you probably know, Nokia today is facing a huge challenge in their business, not from another handset manufacturer, but from companies like Apple and Google and even Microsoft and Research in Motion that make the BlackBerry. And what they've done is they've transferred the basis of competition from making a better phone to all the applications and services that you can access with your phone. And this is where the business is being won or lost today. So even companies like Nokia, as big as they are and as good as they were, are really scrambling now. They just replaced their CEO and brought in a guy from Microsoft, because it isn't enough to make a better product. You've got to now build better services and applications for the product. So that's probably the simplest example.
All right, but before we leave that, we're talking to Henry Chesbrough, everybody, and I want to talk about that because I own the Motorola Razr, and I still use it to this day.
Ah, all right.
So here I am. I'm the dinosaur of 7 years ago, and I understand what you say about the apps, so I'm going to table that for just a minute. But the Razr's downfall, as I recall, wasn't so much that they didn't want to have a follow-up product to it. It was the fact that the Razr started out as an analog phone and didn't make the transition to digital. Mm-hmm. Nokia jumped on digital and said, well, if Motorola's not going to do it, we're going to do it. And Nokia's jump to digital is what allowed them to eat Motorola's lunch. Am I wrong on that?
I don't think you're wrong on that. Motorola did come out with the Crazer, which was the successor phones to the Razr, and they did eventually make the transition to digital. But that was perhaps too little too late.
Mm.
But my point really is, though, that particularly with the Chinese growing their manufacturing base, the Koreans, of course, being very far along, I don't think the U.S. Competitors and your audience members listening in can hope to win just on making better, cheaper, faster cell phones. I think the key to winning now is to build these architectures that can bring in all these other applications and services on top. And that's how I think you're going to sustain an advantage today. Very different from what Michael Porter was saying 25 years ago.
Without a doubt. We're talking to Henry Chesbrough, everybody, author of the book Open Services Innovation, Rethinking Your Business to Grow and Compete in the New Era. And you mentioned apps for these phones, and I think that that is probably the next major battleground, is who has more apps and who has better apps, whether it's Apple versus BlackBerry versus some of the others that are out there on the market today. But isn't really Apple the one who has taken the leadership position in that? And it's not with the phones. They started it back in 2001 when they came up with iTunes, and all they've really done is leverage iTunes into the App Store, and it's allowed them to grow not only into the iPod but also into the iPhone and now the iPad.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's astonishing to think what Apple's been able to do in the last 10 or 12 years. You and I have probably followed this company since its birth.
Yes.
And it's astonishing to see just what a rebirth the company has had with the return of Steve Jobs. And as you probably know, the company is now the second most valuable company in the U.S. stock market after ExxonMobil, which is incredible for a company that was, in 1998, Michael Dell said they ought to shut the company down and return the cash to the shareholders.
Right. Well, no, it is a remarkable story, and it is, I think, the essence of what you're talking about in open services innovation. So help us to understand a little bit more about your book. And what I like about your book is this, Henry, that you look at innovation as not a zero-sum game. You don't look at it as if I create a great phone, that prevents the Chinese from creating another great phone. Or if I have an idea and I share that idea with you, now we both have the idea and we can both do something with it. That's the beautiful thing about innovation. So talk to us about innovation resources and services from your book.
Oh, absolutely. And here's where we can get to Amazon.
Okay.
Because I think it illustrates it so clearly. You know, Amazon began life maybe 16 years ago as the world's largest bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Amazon at the time was intended to suggest just this incredible selection of books that they had. But Amazon today would be a much smaller and less important company if they had stuck to selling books. Today, when you go to Amazon to buy things, you can buy books, of course, but you can buy a whole range of other products like jewelry and electronics and various gifts and consumer household products and lots of different stuff. What's kind of interesting, though, is the way Amazon has done this, because adding all these additional categories of merchandise could be taking on a lot of additional inventory and merchandising risk, and you have the wrong product at the wrong time that customers don't actually want. But that's not how Amazon did it. What they do is they actually opened up the tools that they use to build their own web pages for books, which they do stock, and invited third-party merchants into what they called the Amazon Web Store to build pages to merchandise these goods from their business that go on Amazon's website. So if you're buying books from Amazon, you're getting it from Amazon. If you go buy jewelry, it looks just like it is from books, but the jewelry isn't stocked by Amazon. All of that comes from a third party. So Amazon gets the money, gives the order to the jewelry company. The jewelry company fulfills the order. Amazon pays the jewelry company. The customer deals only with Amazon, and it's a completely consistent experience. So this is a great example of what economists would call economies of scope, where by doing more things, Amazon gives you a wider selection of merchandise to the customer, a consistent experience for the customer, avoids the risks of having to inventory and merchandise that additional stuff, shares that with the third-party merchant. Now, why does the merchant do this? Well, they do it because Amazon's website is one of the most highly trafficked sites anywhere, and people go to Amazon to go shopping.
Right.
So that's where merchants want to be. They want to be where customers are coming to buy things. So the more people that come to Amazon with this broader category of stuff, the more merchants want to be there, too. So it really is this virtuous circle that you were describing before, that you have some things, I have some things. By working together, we can actually do more together than we could by ourselves separately.
We're talking to Henry Chesbrough, everybody. We're talking about open source innovation here. Now, Henry, all the examples we talked about so far have been fairly high-tech examples, but let's bring it back because you've got some examples in the book about General Electric, which in many ways is not what I would consider a high-tech company.
Oh, yeah, I think of them as sort of heavy industry.
Right.
You know, good old basic American manufacturing. And to give General Electric credit, the example I'm about to describe is not something that's all that new. They've been doing it for a number of years. But this has to do with buying jet aircraft engines. GE is one of the world's largest sellers of aircraft engines, along with Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce. But these engines cost tens of millions of dollars each, and so it's a huge capital purchase for airlines to buy these things. What GE realized is, wait, we can actually sell this another way to our customers, and they created a program called Power by the Hour, which essentially takes a multi-million dollar purchase and instead converts it to you only pay us per flight hour when you're using it. And the great thing from the customer's perspective is instead of a big upfront capital investment you've got to make, you only pay for what you use when you're using it. And if your planes are flying, that means you're making money, which means you can pay GE. So it turns a fixed cost into a variable cost for the customer. And GE can price this in ways that they make a nice margin as well. And the kicker that really makes it come home for them is all the aftermarket sales and service for the engines, the spare parts and the maintenance, et cetera, in the Power by the Hour program. GE provides all of that, as opposed to having to share that aftermarket service revenue with third parties, including some of the service technicians that used to work for GE and are out on their own with their own shingle now. servicing these engines on their own.
Oh, it's brilliant. Turning a capital purchase into really a variable cost is brilliant. We're talking to Henry Chesbrough, everybody. Open source innovation, rethinking your business to grow and compete in the new era. And Henry, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book?
Well, I think one thing I want people to take away is that services is not a low-class, low-esteem profession. It's actually an area where you can build new revenue streams and competitive advantage and really sustain a stronger position in your market. I've got a whole chapter on open services innovation for small firms as well, where I examine this for a local sailing club, an engineering services firm, an entertainment network. So I go into examples that where these things started very small and show that even when you're small, you can actually build advantaged relations with your customers that really make you more money in doing that. And the reason I say that in part is in many companies, the product guys are the guys who are the stars. They're the guys who get the accolades, who are the ones who have the most important jobs in the company. And many times the service people are relegated to some back room somewhere where their job is to just placate the customers enough to keep them from screaming out too much. And one thing you can see in my book is that, no, services can be much more than that, and these people deserve the same kind of recognition and influence that we give to the people who make products.
And that's an important lesson to learn. We've been talking to Henry Chesbrough, everybody, author of the book Open Services Innovation. Henry, if people like what they hear, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Let's see. Two places. www.openinnovation.net. And I'm also on Twitter at OpenInno.
At OpenInno on Twitter. Henry, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Bill, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.